Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the National Podcast, normally recorded in our studio at the Bishopbriggs Media Centre, currently recorded from our volunteers' homes. To keep in touch with us, use our social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram and Twitter, which are all at Q and Review. That's CUEANDREVIEW. Or get in touch via information@qandreview.com. That's information@CUEANDREVIEW.com. Please like and share our podcasts and give us any constructive feedback.
From the National, Friday, 2nd of September, 2022. From the Politics section. MSP behind abortion clinic legalisation suggests reason for mediation commission, by Steph Braun. Mediation between anti-abortion protesters and clinic users could have been commissioned to protect buffer zone laws from any legal challenge the MSP behind the legalisation has suggested. The Scottish Government provoked a backlash last month when a contract award notice published online showed it had paid for the services of a civic mediation company for the Centre for Good Relations to support dialogue between parties who hold vigils and protests outside the abortion clinics and those who are affected by them. Ministers quickly confirmed there was no proposals whatsoever to hold meetings between patients and protesters as part of this process, and all that was commissioned was an initial scoping exercise. The Centre for Good Relations has met with various parties to hear their views, the government said, and there is now discussions ongoing as to whether mediation work should continue. Gillian Mackay, the Green MSP behind the Safe Access Zones Bill, has now speculated that the government may have felt it had to at least explore the idea of mediation to give the legalisation the best chance of standing up to what is believed will be inevitable legal challenge down the line. It is understood a public space protection order, PSPO, the legal mechanism used to enact buffer zones in England, was knocked back because of the less restrictive step of mediation was not considered. Mackay, who is not part of the government, was not privy to any decision-making, said she fully empathised with campaign groups who reacted with horror when they saw the contract award, but admitted she could see the logic behind if it was to bolster the legalisation's legitimacy. She told The National, "If you look at the PSPOs down south, I think one of them has not been knocked back because mediation was not a step that was taken before the buffer zone was introduced. The government may have been looking at it as a less restrictive measure that would have been considered before going to buffer zones if this bill was to be challenged. I would hazard a guess that that is part of it, and that having looked at other mechanisms, we don't have the ability to have PSPOs up here, and now they, England, brought it in the safe access zones. If one of them was knocked back for less restrictive step not being considered, I think it would probably be sensible to consider all other less restrictive options. I understand all the campaign groups who are asking why on earth would you want to put patients and protesters together. I cannot stress enough how much I empathise and relate to that view, but there was never a mediation conducted and what was commissioned was a scoping exercise. It shows the commitment of the Scottish Government to make sure this does pass with as few issues as possible. The consolation on Mackay's bill, which would make it legal requirement for there to be a 150-metre protest-free zone around clinics, closed last month after more than 12,000 responses were sent in. She said there was a surge in responses from those opposed to the legalisation in the final days of the survey. Earlier this week, the First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, chaired a second summit on the issue with the most affected councils, Glasgow, Edinburgh and Aberdeen, who agreed to investigate if the 150-metre zones could be brought in at a local level. but the National revealed yesterday how the vast majority of Scottish councils are not considering bylaws which would implement buffer zones. Only Aberdeen City and Edinburgh Council confirmed to the National that they are trying to establish if bringing in bylaws could provide a temporary solution, while Glasgow, which has seen many protests in recent months, declined to comment. While different parties grapple with how to deliver the legalisation in Scotland, we are awaiting decisions of the Supreme Court in Northern Ireland as to whether buffer zone legalisation there is within the devolved government's power. Mackay has already said this will have a bearing on matters proceed. A Scottish government spokesperson said, "All women in Scotland should be able to access timely abortion care without judgment or intimidation." Last year, a working group was formed to explore possible ways to solve the problem of women being harassed outside abortion clinics as quickly as possible. A number of pieces of work have been commissioned by the working group to explore views in this area, including this work and research to develop a detailed picture of women's experiences as a result of the protests. The Centre for Good Relations has met separately with various parties, including Back Off Scotland, as patient representatives to hear their views. There are no proposals whatsoever to hold meetings between patients and protesters as part of this process. The initial scoping phase is complete, and we are currently discussing with the working group and the Centre for Good Relations whether this work should continue, not least as representatives for some protesters appear determined to carry on with their activities without regard for their impact. This is the only one of the number of actions being taken by the Scottish Government remains committed to national legalisation, which is being discussed with Gillian Mackay, MSP, in relation to her proposed bill for safe access zones. And this article was by Steph Braun from The National, Friday, 2nd of September 2022, from the news section. Statistics show elderly are sacrificing hot meals to save money for energy bills, by Jane McLeod. A quarter of older people surveyed by a Scottish charity say that they are buying less food so they can save money to heat their homes as energy costs spiral. Some members of Food Train are also sacrificing hot meals as they try to manage gas and electricity bills amid worries about rapid rising prices. The stark statistics following research by the Older People's Charity has heightened fears that increased number of older Scots will become malnourished this winter. Food Train has written to Scottish Secretary Alistair Jack, calling on the UK government to double the amount paid in its previously announced pensioner cost of living payment to help people cope with the crisis. Chief Executive Michelle Carruthers said, "Our members are very worried about the winter ahead. Many have no idea how they'll cope. Some will have to juggle between keeping warm and keeping fed. This puts people's lives in danger. Without immediate action, alarming numbers of older people are going to be at greater risk of malnutrition and social isolation this winter, causing further health problems and putting further strain on the already under pressure NHS. The reports we are hearing from our members are heartbreaking, alarming and unacceptable. Their concerns are clear and are growing. Doubling the new pensioner cost of living payment will go at least some way towards keeping the heating on and the cupboard stocked this winter." Food Train works with more than 3,000 older people each year across Scotland, helping them to eat well and live well in their homes through a range of shopping, meal making, befriending and other support projects. One person who took part in its cost of living survey among members said, "I might have to reduce my shopping. I don't know how to save money on energy because I need to keep warm. When the temperature drops, I suffer pains." Another said, "It's torture to choose between heat and food." The charity's survey found 27% of those questioned had started buying less food. 25% said they would struggle to pay bills, with 37% having already dipped into savings to make ends meet. 30% switched to cheaper food brands, 60% said they will heat their home less, 41% are cooking more often by microwave to save heating their oven. Explaining the impact of rising costs on the dilemmas they face between heating and eating, some said they were already only heating part of their homes, were showering less often to save on power, eating sandwiches for main meals, and have stopped buying new clothes. A woman told Food Train, "I eat salads so I don't need to use electricity. I can't afford it and don't have any savings to dip into." Another added, "It's very difficult not to give way to depression. I feel cold. I don't turn on the heating. I put on more clothes." Others are going out less often to save money, increasing the risk of social isolation. Food Train's grocery shopping service has forced sustained record high demand across Scotland since the onset of the corona pandemic, making more than 60,000 shopping deliveries across Scotland in the last 12 months. And that article was by Jane McLeod.
This article is from The National, date 5th September 2022. From the News section. LGBT activists march on Scottish Parliament with call for bolder trans rights reforms. By Abby Garton Crosby. Activists from four of Holyrood's main parties marched on the Scottish Parliament calling for bolder reforms to be brought in for transgender people. Equality campaigners from the Out for Independence, Rainbow Greens, Scottish Labour's LGBT plus wing and Lib Dems walked en masse from Edinburgh's City Chambers to Holyrood demanding trans rights now. Five members of the Scottish Family Party greeted the activists as they arrived outside the Parliament's doors while holding huge placards with anti-trans sentiments. They tried to interrupt speeches on numerous occasions, but were drowned out by the cheering and whooping crowd. The Gender Recognition Act, or GRA, was laid in the Scottish Parliament on March 2nd last year by Social Justice Secretary Shona Robinson, with a call for an end to the abusive rhetoric surrounding the reforms. The bill is intended to make it easier for a trans person to acquire a gender recognition certificate, or GRC, to legally live in their acquired gender. This includes removing the requirement for a medical diagnosis of gender dysphoria, allowing the trans person to self-ID, the power to award a GRC given to the Registrar General instead of a medical panel, and allowing the trans person to live in their acquired gender for 3 months as opposed to 2 years. However, there have been concerns raised that the legislation does not provide protection for non-binary people in Scotland who do not identify as either gender. Beth Douglas, co-convener of the Rainbow Greens and organiser of the march, said that there were numerous pieces of legislation making their way through the Scottish Parliament, such as the GRA, a ban on conversion therapy, and reform into trans health care. She told The National, "We just want to make the case on the day that the Scottish Parliament opened back up to the public and on the eve of MSPs coming back tomorrow, we wanted to remind them that we are here. We want them to be bolder. We want them to go further. The current GRA reforms aren't world leading. There are countries that are already doing better than what we've proposed. And we really want to say to MSPs of all colours that this is a cross-party issue. We've seen groups from the Lib Dems, the SNP, Scottish Labour, as well as the Scottish Greens come together and say this is the right thing to do. This is what being progressive is, and we should be bolder and wholeheartedly commit to trans rights in the next Parliament." Ellie Gomersall, President of NUS Scotland and the first openly trans woman to hold post, said that trans issues are something we should all be fighting for, adding that she had been on the waiting list for healthcare for 4 years and 7 days. She said, "The current waiting list for trans care is absolutely horrific. It's absolutely crazy. The problem is a result that a lot of trans people are having to resort to private healthcare just to be able to survive until they see someone through the NHS. It's not just the waiting lists that are the problem." Gomersall added that the Scottish Government had committed funding to bring waiting lists down, but more action is needed. She added, "That will help to some extent, but the entire system is broken because, as it currently stands, is designed by non-trans people under this idea of what we need. And as a result, it's intrusive, invasive, conforms to gender stereotypes very often, and it can be difficult for trans people to access that healthcare." Gomersall also said she had concerns for trans students during the cost of living and housing crisis, as they are more likely to be discriminated against, struggle to find jobs, at risk of homelessness, and ultimately may drop out of their studies. Maggie Chapman, Scottish Greens MSP and the party's equalities spokesperson, insisted the GRA reform will pass in the current parliamentary term, as it is a key part of the Bute House cooperation agreement signed with the SNP after the 2021 Holyrood elections. She added, "Trans rights are human rights, and it's really important that we stand in solidarity with trans people and all members of the LGBT community. The attack we are seeing on trans rights and trans people over the last few years is unacceptable. There is no place for transphobia in Scotland, and we need to stand in solidarity and make sure that everyone knows trans people are welcome here." That article was by Abby Garton Crosby. This article is from The National, date 5th September 2022. From the Culture section. Martin Lewis despairs on GMB as Edwina Curry shares energy-saving foil tip. By Joshua Searle. Martin Lewis was left with his head in his hands on Good Morning Britain after hearing guest Edwina Curry's money-saving tips. The money-saving expert is on Good Morning Britain all week as he tried to help people save money amid soaring energy costs and the cost of living crisis. The price cap is set to rise to £3,549 on October 1st, Ofgem confirmed, an 80% increase on the previous figure of £1,971. The price cap figure of £3,549 applies to homes on default tariffs, paying by direct debit and based on typical use. Featuring as a guest after a disagreement on Twitter last week, Edwina Curry, who accused Lewis of sensationalising the cost of living crisis, faced the UK, shared some of her money-saving hacks. Holding up a bit of reflector foil, she said, "Here is one of my suggestions for a tip, something that is cheap. Martin knows about this, I'm sure. If you put some of this behind your radiators, it really works and makes the whole room nice and warm. It means you can turn down your thermostat without it causing you any more discomfort. Most people my age lived in houses without central heating, but we are dependent on it now." The former Tory MP has also suggested moving the sofa away from radiators so you're heating the whole room and not just the sofa. Martin Lewis and co-host Susanna Reid were left with their heads in their hands following the suggestions. That article was by Joshua Searle. This article is from The National, date 5th September 2022. from the politics section. Ministry of Defence awarded £24 million of taxpayers' cash to Tory minister linked Centreprise International. By Hamish Morrison. The husband of a Tory minister works for a firm which was reportedly awarded £24 million of government contracts, it has been revealed. Gillian Keegan, a health minister, is married to Michael, who works as a Cabinet Office civil servant, responsible for the government's relationship with suppliers, but also holds a non-executive role on the board of Centreprise International. The company has received millions from the UK government for designing IT systems for the Ministry of Defence, The Sun reports. Centreprise International has boasted of its Ministry of Defence contracts on its website, but The National was not immediately able to confirm how much money it has been awarded. The Ministry of Defence was approached for comment. The paper said that between October 2019 and May 2020, the firm was awarded 17 contracts for its services. The Cabinet Office has insisted that Michael Keegan plays no role in awarding contracts. A spokesperson for the department said, "We have a clear conflicts of interest process that ensures that all conflicts are identified and recorded formally, and this safeguards our procurement and commercial processes." Michael Keegan is responsible for managing the relationship between the government and BAE Systems. He plays no role in awarding contracts to suppliers and declared his position at Centreprise as part of the Cabinet Office's conflicts of interest process. They added that Michael Keegan has agreed to remove himself from any conversations regarding bidding for public centre contracts and said this was a long-standing arrangement. Suggestions of wrongdoing were unfounded, the spokesperson said. Labour branded the deals an example of vested Tory interests at the centre of government. The National has approached Centreprise International for comment. John Healey, Labour's shadow Defence Secretary, told the paper, "This smacks of dodgy crony contracts at the heart of the defence procurement. Protecting British armed servicemen and women is the most important duty of any Defence Secretary. Our British troops and taxpayers deserve better." That article was by Hamish Morrison.
From The National, Monday the 5th of September 2022, from the comment section, review, carefully selected poetry anthology is sure to fire curious minds, by Gemma E. McLaughlin. "And Everything Will Be Glad to See You," selected by Ella Resbiger and illustrated by Anna Shapetha, published by Nosy Crow. "And Everything Will Be Glad to See You" targets young readers as a heartwarming introductory poetry anthology. In selecting these poems, Risbridge made the choice not to include poetry for men, so to better highlight the history of women being left out of literature, with many writers having to stay anonymous or use a masculine pen name. This challenges the girls of the present, who are about to be the women of the future, to cherish poetry and writing, even if this is not what they do themselves, and to find inspiration in it to take through life. It's a perfect gift for the children in your life, a memorable and beautifully illustrated anthology which effortlessly presents not only exciting tricks of language found in poetry, but also of family, growth, and seeing the world with both hope and determination to improve it. There is not one simple theme to the poems contained within this collection, but rather a journey of ideas flowing from one to the next. This is achieved with no strict subheadings, but rather small groupings of similar poems against the backdrop of related illustrations. Some of these are shorter than others, lasting only two poems, while other themes can be found in little ways throughout, such as observations on nature with references to climate change. It speaks about growing confidence in your relationships, and in yourself, to follow all that you want to do and create. From this, there is an understanding of why poetry as a medium has so much power emotionally. How you can be brought to see the world, or even one item or one person, from the perspective of someone you've never known, to have what they see presented to you in such a way that you can almost see it too. Seeing this for the first time, with such carefully chosen poetry that is accessible for young minds brims with possibility. Seeing something as a writer many years or miles away from you can explain better than any lecture how we are inherently connected, that all emotions feel so revolutionary or even scary or universal. When the poetry has been read, there are two indexes, one of poets and one of poems, with the page number on which they can be found listed. The value of this in an anthology is that you can remember which writer or piece was your favourite and explore further, learn more about one person's writing, one style of poetry, or read more about the ideas it expressed. In her afterword, Rishi said, "I hope the poems in this book light your way to all sorts of things. Think of these poems not like still pictures, but more like doors, things you can push on, and that will open onto other things. This book is truly something special and loving." And that review was by Gemma E. McLaughlin. From the National, Tuesday the 6th of September 2022, from the Politics section, Boris Johnson makes dig at Nicola Sturgeon in final speech as Prime Minister, by Adam Robertson. In his farewell speech as Prime Minister, Boris Johnson said that those trying to break up the union will never ever succeed. The outgoing PM was speaking outside Downing Street for the final time on Tuesday morning, ahead of his resignation. He was greeted by applause from various MPs outside Number 10, including some of his most loyal supporters such as Nadine Dorries, who is expected to resign as Culture Secretary. In an apparent dig at First Minister Nicola Sturgeon, who is pledged to hold an independence referendum in 2023, Johnson said that "we are one whole and entire United Kingdom." He claimed the union is so strong that those who want to break it up will keep trying, but they will never ever succeed, despite around half of Scots supporting leaving the union, according to a recent poll. As expected, Johnson proceeded to reel off a list of everything he has done whilst in office, including pushing through Brexit, rolling out the vaccine and sending weapons to Ukraine. He will now head to Balmoral, where he will officially resign to the Queen. On the cost of living, Johnson said that despite the naysayers, the new government would get people through the ongoing cost of living crisis. Johnson said he knew that compassionate Conservative government would get people through the crisis. He also spoke about Putin and said that the Russian president was utterly deluded to think he could blackmail or bully the British people. The outgoing PM added that the unemployment is down to levels not seen since I was about 10 years old and bouncing around in a space hopper. He disguised himself as being like one of those booster rockets that has fulfilled its function. And that article was by Adam Robertson. From the National, Tuesday the 6th of September 2022, from the news section, levy on big whiskey would raise up to £1 billion for public services. Article by Xander Eliard, political reporter. The Scottish Government should bring in tariffs on big whiskey to avoid cutting public services amid the cost of living crisis, the SNP's trade union group, SNP-TUG, has said. The group welcomed the pay deal which saw bin and education strikes across Scotland's councils averted in early September, but questioned why cuts would be needed in other areas. After the First Minister Nicola Sturgeon intervened, trade unions Unison, Unite and the GMB said they would recommend that their members accept a new pay deal worth some £600 million. However, Sturgeon said that, because the Scottish Government has got a finite budget that is not itself rising at the rate of inflation, balancing the books would require horrendously difficult decisions. The SNP-TUG, which represents some 14,000 members, has instead called for taxes to be levied on the most wealthy in society, with a specific target on the backs of big whiskey. The group's convener, Bill Ramsey, said, "We welcome the best possible pay settlements for public sector workers, who are being hammered by the cost of living crisis, and we are pleased that SNP councillors and MPs have joined picket lines with us." The First Minister has also worked hard for resolution of industrial disputes brought about by inflation and the abject failure of the UK government. But the Scottish Government must also do everything it can to avoid cuts to public services in the light of the economic squeeze. We must not set workers against public services, or vice versa. As well as demanding action from Westminster, that means thinking creatively about how the best use of the limited powers we do have. This certainly includes looking at how we would raise up to £1 billion from the big, corporate end of the whisky industry, money which at present largely goes overseas. Writing in the National, Ramsay argued that it is time Scotland's big party takes on big whisky. Not the wee craft and niche distilleries, but the giants who run the Scottish Whisky Association, SWA, and its extensive and hugely effective lobbying arm, he adds. If what amounts to a special industrial water rate, and some other measures, are within the competence of current devolved powers, then some between £250 million and £1 billion could be raised. Such a levy would not touch the size of the multi-billion pound global profitability of Scotch. If the SWA and its lobbyists feel otherwise, then let's have an open debate about that. The cost of living crisis demands that all such options be considered. Under the Scotland Act, all local taxes are devolved, meaning there could be scope to introduce whisky bottling levies at a council level. The SNP TUG has also submitted a motion to be considered for the party's full conference, due to be held in Aberdeen in early October, calling for a feasibility study into the possibility of a whisky levy. It is urging members to support the motion in a choice ballot which will be sent out ahead of the conference. A separate motion submitted by the group, calling on the Scottish Government to creatively use its devolved powers to raise taxes on the highest earners, was dropped from the agenda. A Scottish Government spokesperson said, "Tax policy for 2023-24 will be announced in the upcoming Scottish Budget, as per the normal fiscal process." And that article is by Xander Eliards.
Reported from the National on the 6th of September 2022. From the Culture section, recorded by Amy. Sandman author Neil Gaiman praises Scott's translation of Carline after Len Penny shares chapter, by Craig Meehan. A Scott's translation of a famous children's book has been hailed as marvellous by its original author. Neil Gaiman took to Twitter to share his admiration for the translation of his dark fantasy novella, Carline, after being alerted to its Scots language campaigner, Len Penny. Writer Thomas Clark posted a section of the translation on Twitter after seeing the success of Netflix's The Sandman, adapted from the English author's comic book of the same name. Sharing a part of the first chapter, Clark said, "Seeing as Obadi's geeing at Biglicks about Sandman, the new, and starting a translation at Neil himself into Scots a wee while sin. Dinny ken if it'll ever see light of day, but here's a wee look at Carline in Scotland's either national language." The translation reads, "Carline found the door a wee while after they'd flit it into the hoose. It was an offy old hoose. It had an attic under the roof and a cellar under the ground and a growthy garden with old muckle trees in it. Carline's family didn't own the hale hoose. It is o'er muckle for thone. Instead, they owned a bit of it. There was other folk that bidded in the old hoose." Gaiman saw the post, telling his 3 million followers, "This is marvellous to read. I'm loving reading Carline in translation." Clark, who previously translated Diary of a Wimpy Kid and A Series of Unfortunate Events, said he'd been working on a Scots Carline since before lockdown after being a long-time fan. He told The National, "I started working on the Scots translation of Carline in 2021. I'd read and loved the book long before, but it occurred to me for the first time that a Scots version of the book might really work. So I had a wee blether with my publisher, Itchy Koo, about the viability of a Scots language Carline, and started work on the initial chapters just to see how it would look. To me, what came out of it was hugely exciting. The Scots seemed to match up incredibly well with the dark fantasy of the original, and I was really enjoying doing it. When lockdown came into effect, the translation was put on the back burner," Clark said, as he worked on other projects. "But with the release of The Sandman on Netflix, the Scot felt inspired to get back to translating. The massive positive reaction to Sandman, which is a TV adaptation of Neil's fantasy graphic novels, reminded me that I had the Scots translation of Gaiman sitting around on my hard drive that almost nobody had seen, he said. So I tweeted out the first page of it just in case anybody was interested. I didn't expect Neil himself to see it, but Len Penny, incredibly kind, put him onto it. Obviously, I'm incredibly flattered and delighted that a man whose writing has given me so much pleasure over the years should have such a positive reaction to my work. And it's lovely to see other fans of Neil Gaiman who are enthused about the idea of a Scots Core line as I am. That article was by Craig Meehan.
The National News on Wednesday, the 7th of September. Delayed Calmac ferries on track to be delivered in 2023. An article written by Ninian Wilson. Two delayed vessels at the centre of a Scottish Government row are still on track to be delivered during 2023. Business Minister Ivan McKee confirmed the MV Glen Sannox and the as-yet-unnamed Hull 802 still have a completion date target of May 2023 and December 2023 respectively. The vessels were originally due to have been completed in 2018. Following the award of the contract to the Ferguson Marine Shipyard in 2015, the construction of the two Calmac ferries was plagued with delays and the shipyard was nationalised. Asked by Scottish Conservative MSP Edward Mountain whether the two ferries would be completed by the revised target and whether they were still within the latest cost to complete budget of £123 million, Mr. McKee confirmed this to be the case. We continue to press the shipyard to continue to progress to completion of the vessels within this timeframe and within budget, the SNP MSP added. The Port Glasgow shipyard is increasingly becoming more competitive to allow it to bid for other business going forward. An article written by Ninian Wilson. The National Politics on Wednesday, the 7th of September. London Mayor praises bold rent freeze. An article written by Xander Eliards. London Mayor Sadiq Khan has praised the bold action from the Scottish Government after Nicola Sturgeon announced a rent freeze. The SNP First Minister said that, in effect, rents in Scotland would be frozen from today. Ms Sturgeon said that rents would be frozen at current levels until at least March the 31st, 2023, and that there would also be a ban on evictions. Speaking to MSPs at the launch of the 2022-2023 programme for government, she said, "The Scottish Government does not have the power to stop your energy bill soaring, but we can and will ensure that your rent does not rise. By definition, these are temporary measures, but they will provide much-needed security during what will be a difficult winter." Green co-leader and Minister for Tenants' Rights, Patrick Harvey, is expected to bring forward the emergency legislation. Responding to the announcement, London's Labour mayor praised the bold action from the Scottish Government and called for the UK Government to give him the power to do the same. Mr Khan said, "This bold action from the Scottish Government will support thousands of households during this national crisis. I'll continue to call on the UK Government to grant me the power to freeze rent in our capital. Londoners face record rents at the worst possible time." Ros Foyer, General Secretary of the Scottish Trades Union Congress, also praised the freeze. She said, "Today's programme for government shows what can be achieved through industrial action and collective campaigning. The Scottish Government is to be commended for freezing rents. If implemented correctly, and we are pressing for further answers, this will help thousands of Scottish households when they need it most. When used, the powers of our Parliament can bring positive change. This must now extend to Scotland's tax powers." An article written by Xander Eliards. The National Politics on Wednesday, the 7th of September. Cost of living help tops the agenda in First Minister's programme for government. An article written by Judith Duffy. Nicola Sturgeon branded the cost of living crisis a humanitarian emergency as she set out plans to support Scots, including rent controls, increasing child support payments and freezing train fares. The First Minister outlined a raft of measures as she set out her plans for the year ahead in the programme for government, but warned Holyrood does not have the powers to act in the manner and on the scale needed. She told MSPs she's written to the new Prime Minister Liz Truss, renewing a request for an emergency Four Nations summit on the cost crisis, and that action on a scale similar to the COVID responses was needed now to pull the UK back from the brink. Ms Sturgeon said, "This programme for government is published in the context of the most severe cost crisis in our lifetimes. This crisis is pushing millions into poverty, it's threatening the viability of businesses, and it will almost certainly push the UK economy into recession. It poses a danger, not just to livelihoods, but also to lives. It is, to be blunt, a humanitarian emergency." The First Minister urged the UK government to cancel the October energy price cap rise and freeze energy prices at the current level. She also called for greater powers to borrow to be granted to the Scottish Government, as she outlined rising budgetary pressures, saying it limited the government's ability to respond as fully as we want to do. The First Minister said this year's budget was already 2.9% lower than last year, and since then, rising inflation is now worth a staggering £1.7 billion less than when it was published last December. She said, "In addition, and by necessity, we're also spending more in some areas than was anticipated. For example, the public sector pay deals are so far costing £700 million more than we budgeted for." To be clear, I don't begrudge a single penny of that. On the contrary, paying higher wages is the biggest contribution we can make to helping families with soaring costs. Our powers over tax and borrowing are also woefully inadequate. So unless Westminster increases the total amount of money available, every additional percentage point on a pay deal and every pound we spend on measures to help with rising costs must be funded by reductions elsewhere in our budget, the First Minister added. She said a statement on an emergency budget review would be made today by John Swinney, who is covering the Finance Secretary duties, but warned some plans would need to be halted to fund essential support during the cost of living crisis. The programme for government also includes a Scottish independence referendum bill. If the Supreme Court rules that a vote is within the competence of the Scottish Parliament, Ms Sturgeon said her government will legislate for a referendum on October the 19th, 2023. She said, "This current crisis highlights starkly the pressing need for independence. We are being reminded every day that where and in whose hands power lies really matters. This crisis is much worse in the UK than in other developed countries because of a Brexit that Scotland voted against but was powerless to stop." The plan she set out included the introduction of emergency legislation to introduce a rent freeze, which will apply to both the private and social rental sectors, and a moratorium on evictions. ScotRail fares will also be frozen until at least March 2023. The Scottish Government will double the Fuel Insecurity Fund from £10 million to £20 million this year. It'll give local authorities flexibility to use discretionary housing payments to help with energy costs as well as rent payments. Eligibility for the Tenant Grant Fund, introduced as part of the Scottish Government's COVID response, will be extended to provide help to those struggling to pay rent. Ms Sturgeon's confirmed plans to increase the Scottish child payment to £25 per eligible child per week from November the 14th. The benefit will now also be open to all eligible under 16s, meaning that around 400,000 children will be eligible. The current payments of £20 a week currently help an estimated 104,000 youngsters under the age of 6. Other measures introduced include the introduction of a criminal justice bill, which will see the not proven verdict abolished. If approved, it will be a change of truly historic significance in Scotland, Ms Sturgeon said. A police complaints and misconduct handling bill will also be introduced in a bid to improve the way in which complaints about the police are managed and investigated. Local authorities across Scotland will now have the power to introduce taxes on tourists staying overnight in their areas. Meanwhile, the NHS recovery plan will also be supported by more than £1 billion of targeted investment over this Parliament. Ms Sturgeon said, "Despite the uncertainties we face and the current limitations on our powers to act, this programme for government seeks to chart a path towards a better future. We'll do everything possible to support people and businesses through the difficult months ahead. We'll do so in a manner consistent with our values and our long-term vision for Scotland." An article written by Judith Duffy. The National News on Wednesday, the 7th of September. Number of schools marked as good or satisfactory reaches record high. An article written by Adam Robertson. The number of school buildings in a good or satisfactory condition has reached a record high, Scotland's Education Secretary has said. However, around 1 in 10 are still considered to be poor or bad, the latest statistics show. Some 90.4% of schools were in a good or satisfactory condition as of April 2022, according to this year's Schools Estate Statistics, released on Tuesday, with 91.7% of students being taught in schools with this ranking. Statistics show there were 713 schools inspected that were rated good, and 1,526 rated satisfactory, making up 90.4% of institutions in Scotland, compared to 84% in 2016. Shirley-Ann Somerville said, "We now have a record number of schools in a good or satisfactory condition. Our long-term commitment to education in partnership with local government is clear through our £2 billion Learning Estate Investment Programme, which will benefit 50,000 learners across Scotland." These latest statistics illustrate how our investment is making a real difference to thousands of children and young people, with a record 281,070 children now being educated in good condition schools. Inspectors rated 232 buildings as poor in 2022, a fall of 241 from last year, while two were rated as bad, a rise from just one in the year before. Around four schools, or 0.4%, were not inspected, according to the report. Figures also showed the number of children receiving free school meals has climbed to 215,053. Ms. Somerville said, "It's also encouraging to see the number of free school meals provided to children up by over 30,000 since we extended universal provision across all of Primary 1 to Primary 5. An article written by Adam Robertson. The National News on Wednesday, the 7th of September. Research traces porridge back 5,500 years. An article written by Jane McLeod. Scots have been eating porridge for 5,500 years, according to new discoveries which trace the national dish back to Stone Age settlers in the Outer Hebrides. Although oats were not introduced to Scotland until 600 AD and barley porridge was previously discovered 2,500 years ago, the new find on a number of Hebridean islands traces a wheat paste alternative back further by around 3,000 years. Lead author and chemist Dr. Simon Haman of Bristol University said, "Our results represent the first direct evidence for the cooking of cereals in Neolithic pots from the 4th millennium BC. They indicate Neolithic communities in the region may have been consuming wheat between 3600 and 3300 BC. Wheat may have been cooked with dairy products to produce a milk-based gruel or porridge. Farmers would mix dairy products with milk to create an early form of stew, which was discovered by chemical analysis on incredibly well-preserved pottery fragments. They were unearthed in waters on ancient crannogs, artificial islands made by erecting shelters on lochs." Co-author Dr. Lucy Cramp said, "This research gives us a window into the culinary traditions of early farmers living at the northwestern edge of Europe, whose lifeways are little understood. It gives us the first glimpse of the sort of practices that were associated with these enigmatic island locations. Ceramic vessels were scanned by chemists and have identified traces of lipids strongly associated with cereals, suggesting the two were cooked together as a milk-based porridge. The wheat uncovered was of indeterminate species, but may trace back to the more modern relative that gives us porridge oats, Alvena sativa." Dr. Haman said, "Gas chromatography and high-resolution mass spectrometry were then used to analyse organic residues from these pottery remains. We detected molecular biomarkers for cereals indicating wheat and other foods that were cooked in the vessels. It shows wheat may have been more present in Neolithic diets in this region than previously thought. It may have been prepared with dairy products, perhaps as a type of milk-based gruel or porridge. A strong link was identified with the size of the pottery and its usage, with smaller mouthed vessels associated with dairy products. Dr. Hamann said wheat may have played a larger role than previously thought in the diets of Hebridean Neolithic communities. He added, "Here we demonstrate cereal-specific markers can survive in cooking pots for millennia. They reveal consumption of a specific cereal wheat that is virtually absent from the archaeobotanical record for this region, illuminating culinary traditions among early farming communities." Project Director Professor Duncan Garrow of Reading University said, "This research has hugely improved our knowledge of these sites." The research, published in the Nature journal, was titled "Neolithic Culinary Traditions Revealed by Cereal, Milk and Meat Lipids in Pottery from Scottish Crannogs." An article written by Jane MacLeod. The National News on Wednesday the 7th of September. Tourist tax powers to be given to Scotland's local councils under SNP plans. An article written by Xander Eliads. Local authorities across Scotland will have the power to levy a tourist tax under a bill to be proposed by the Scottish Government. Announced in the annual Programme for Government, which was published on Tuesday, the local visitor levy will allow councils to introduce taxes on tourists staying overnight in their areas. The 36-page document lays out 17 bills which the SNP Green Government will hope to introduce in the 2022-2023 parliamentary session. Though details are currently thin on the ground, a council will be able to levy a charge on overnight stays in accommodation, applying over the whole or just a part of their authority area. Nicola Sturgeon told MSPs on Tuesday that the tourist tax would give local authorities additional fiscal flexibility. She added, "This will help councils, if they so choose, to fund activities related to tourism and related infrastructure." Under the Scotland Act, the Parliament at Holyrood has the devolved power to create whichever local taxes it may choose. The funds will be kept by local authorities, which will help fund local services and activities. In 2021, the then SNP-controlled Edinburgh City Council considered introducing a £2 tax per visitor per night. It was estimated that this could raise around £11 million per year. The party pledged again to bring in such a tax ahead of the local election in May 2022. However, the fallout from that vote saw Labour lean on Tory and Lib Dem votes to take power over the capital's council. After the Programme for Government announcement, Cammy Day, Edinburgh's council leader, said, "We believe it's right to ask visitors to make a small contribution to help us sustain and improve our tourism offer while managing its impact. Ultimately, the income this generates will help us continue to invest in and manage the success of tourism on our city, making sure we continue to offer one of the most enviable and enjoyable visitor experiences in the world, while bringing new and additional benefits to our residents who live and work here all year round." A study in 2018 suggested that a tourist tax would not deter the vast majority of people from visiting Edinburgh. Speaking to the Sunday National in August, the head of policy and research at the Commonweal think tank, Craig Diehl, said that tourist taxes are almost ubiquitous in some European nations. He highlighted how they're used to shift the tax burden from the local population onto visitors, saying that some areas use the funding for public transport and gift visitors a travel pass to use during their stay in return. The local tourist levy was one of the proposals, such as a change to council tax or a whisky levy, which were put forward as possible ways which the Scottish Government could raise funds to tackle the cost of living crisis without overstepping its devolved powers. The tourist tax proposal was first put forward 4 years ago, with delays following the onset of the COVID lockdowns. The General Secretary of the Scottish Trades Union Congress, Ros Foyer, said a tourist tax would be a step in the right direction. An article written by Xander Eliads.
Recorded from the National on the 8th of September 2022, from the Culture section, recorded by Amy. Doric writer Shane Strachan named as the new Scots Screever, by Ross Hunter. An Aberdeenshire writer has been awarded the position of Scots Screever. Writer and performer Shane Strachan will champion the dialect of North East Scots, known as Doric, while holding the residency, which is hosted by the National Library of Scotland. The post will give Strachan the opportunity to explore the richness of the National Library Scots language collections, as well as giving him the time to produce work in Doric. Speaking in Doric, the Aberdeenshire-born writer said, "I'm fair trickit to be this year's Scots Weaver, especially getting to promote the Doric of my home region, Aberdeenshire, to folk that bide here and anybody else online. Brought up in the fishing towns of Fraserburgh and Peterhead, I've been speaking Doric all my life and scriven in it for 16 years. Say it's an honour to hold this awful rare position with the National Library of Scots across the next year." National Librarian Amina Shah said Strachan would continue the success of the Scots Squeaver programme, which has helped promote the use of different dialects of Scots since its launch in 2015. "We are delighted with the progress made through the Squeaver programme," she said. "It has really helped to showcase the diversity and breadth of the Scots language." Last year, Orkney Squeaver Alison Miller's exploration of new genres alongside champion Orcadian writing, both locally and further afield, celebrated Orkney as a stronghold of contemporary Scots. Now, with the appointment of Aberdeenshire Squeaver Shane Strachan, we are excited to welcome a fresh, dynamic voice to celebrate Doric as yet another facet in modern, vibrant and contemporary Scots writing. Alan Bett, Head of Literature and Publishing at Creative Scotland, said, "This Squeaver is a rare opportunity for a writer to be provided time and support to create a new writing in Scots. Shane Strachan is an excellent choice, able to create work in a range of literary disciplines, the ability to tap into literary heritage of the language, and produce exciting creative work sure to connect with a broad contemporary audience." The 12-month Scots Squeaver residency is funded by the National Lottery through Creative Scotland. That article was by Ross Hunter. Recorded from the National on the 8th of September 2022, from the Culture section, recorded by Amy. New research sheds light on devastating dinosaur extinction event, by Gregor Young. The meteorite that wiped out Earth's dinosaurs instantly ignited forest wildfires up to thousands of kilometres from its impact zone, scientists have discovered. The 6-mile-wide meteorite struck the Yucatan Peninsula in what is now Mexico at the end of the Cretaceous period 66 million years ago. Its devastating impact brought the region of dinosaurs to an abrupt end by triggering their sudden mass extinction, along with the end of almost 3/4 of the plant and animal species then living on Earth, scientists say. By analysing rocks dating to the time of the strike, a team of geoscientists from the UK, Mexico and Brazil has recently discovered that fires broke out within minutes, at most, of the impact, in areas stretching up to 2,500 kilometres, 1,553 miles, or more from where the meteor struck. In a newly published study, they said wildfires that broke out in the coastal areas were short-lived, as the backwash from the mega tsunami caused by the impact swept charred trees offshore. And by studying the fossilised tree bark, the geoscientists discovered that fires had already begun by the time the trees were washed away. Professor Ben Neller from the University of Aberdeen School of Geosciences, who is among the co-authors, said, "Ultimately, our research confirms how and when these devastating fires were begun, and paints a vivid and quite terrifying picture of what happened in the immediate aftermath of the meteorite strike." This study was supported by Shell Brazil under the Brazilian government's Science Without Borders programme. That article was by Gregor Young. Recorded from the National on the 7th of September 2022. From the Culture section. Recorded by Amy. Scotland set for world first after Arbicke plans green distillery in Angus. By Craig Meehan. Scotland is set for a world first after a spirits producer announced plans to build pioneering green hydrogen-powered distillery. Arbicke Distillery has just received planning permission to construct a 1 MW wind turbine on its farm in Lunan Bay near Montrose. The Angus company is aiming to be one of the world's most sustainable distilleries. The turbine will export its generation to a green hydrogen hub at the distillery, comprising an electrolyzer, compressor and storage. Green hydrogen will be created by the electrolyzer, and the stored hydrogen will be used by a burner and boiler to create steam to deliver the heat for distillation. Arbicke, which makes Highland Rye, the first rye Scotch whisky for almost 200 years, is a field-to-bottle distiller that grows all the ingredients needed to distill their spirits on their farms. It comes after the firm launched the world's only climate-positive gin, Nadar, in 2020 with a carbon footprint of -1.54 kilograms carbon dioxide per 700 ml bottle. John Sterling, co-owner of Urbicki Distillery, said, "This is the potential to transform the distilling industry. We are delighted to be working with energy experts, Locogen and Logan Energy. We aim to be one of the world's most sustainable distilleries, so being able to use green hydrogen power will be another significant step on our sustainability journey." Bill Ireland, CEO of Logan Energy, said, "As demand to switch to net zero technologies continues to grow, this project is a good example of the important role hydrogen can play. We're incredibly proud to be supporting Urbicki in their net zero ambitions," Andy Lyle, CEO of Locogen, said. "This is a great step forward for Urbicki as we help them demonstrate how distilleries can use new technologies to create cleaner, sustainable businesses." That article was by Craig Meehan.
From The National, Thursday the 8th of September 2022, from the sports section. Celtic's Champions League foes RB Leipzig appoint Marco Rose as new boss. By Ewan Payton. RB Leipzig have appointed their new manager. Celtic's Champions League rivals sacked Domenico Tedesco yesterday following their shock 4-1 defeat to Shakhtar Donetsk. Marco Rose has been selected as the man to lead the Bundesliga side going forward. Leipzig CEO Oliver Mintzlaff said, "The decision to part ways with Domenico Tedesco was a very difficult one for us. We had a very successful second half of last season under his tenure, and we qualified for the Champions League. Under his leadership, we also won the DFB Pokal, our first major title, and he was part of the most successful season in our young club's history. For this, Domenico and his coaching staff deserve our gratitude. Domenico is a fantastic coach who will have a lot of success in the future. However, after our mediocre start to the Bundesliga season, with 5 points from 5 games, along with the recent defeats to Eintracht and Shakhtar, we believe that a change of management is the right course of action to change things round quickly. Our priority is RB Leipzig, and we have goals that we want to achieve. We have therefore come to the conclusion that we need a change within the club. We regret that we are going our separate ways, and we would like to thank Domenico for what he has achieved. We wish him nothing but the best for the future." That article was by Ewan Payton. From The National, Thursday the 8th of September 2022, from the sports section. Dusan Tadic details Ajax master plan to exploit Rangers' weaknesses. By Mark Walker. Ajax captain Dusan Tadic revealed they deliberately targeted Rangers by pressing them all over the pitch, and he warned the Ibrox side they were nowhere even near their best. Rangers slumped to a disastrous 4-0 defeat in their return to the Champions League group stages in the Netherlands and were second best all over the pitch. And the Amsterdam club's Serbian skipper admitted they had it pre-planned about the way to target Giovanni van Bronckhorst's side. He said, "We put a lot of pressure on our opponent and we had discussed doing that before the game. The team spirit was good and everyone was committed to each other. We played a lot of good football. We made it a great evening for our fans and this was a strong message we sent out. In the last few games, I don't think I have played particularly well and I have been in a new position. But sometimes you have to do what's important for the team. We can play better though, and I think this is only the beginning for us." An Ajax hero and man of the match, Mohamed Kudus, insisted he is only concentrating on Ajax after seeing a transfer day deadline move to Everton denied by the club. Kudus even went on to strike in a bid to push through the move, but insists he's settled his differences now. He said, "The man of the match trophy is for the whole team and not just for me. As for what happened last week, I spoke to the manager and it was not a big thing. I will continue to give everything for the club." This article was by Mark Walker.
From The National of Thursday, the 8th of September, 2022, from the comments section, Leslie Riddoch, "Human hand grenade Liz Truss should be a gift for the Yes movement." Boris, you are admired from Kiev to Carlisle. A long,
Awkward silence ensued. Only 3 seconds, but still longer than anything experienced during the long years of uber-confident Boris Johnson. Yes, in the first minute of her first speech as PM, Liz Truss had accidentally succeeded in exposing a damning, if partial, truth. Was Brexiting Boris truly admired anywhere in Europe beyond Ukraine? It's highly doubtful. But her unfortunate choice of an English border town as UK terminus of the Boris admiration arc served only to remind listeners there was never any admiration north of it. Whoops. Whether that was intended as a direct snub to Scotland. If she can ignore our First Minister, why not the whole country? Or just a subconscious recognition of the Tories' enduring unpopularity in Scotland. Fuck ends. After all, if she wanted tunes that start with a K, Kilbarchan, Kilmarnock and Kinning Park would have served equally well, all near her home port of Paisley, but all, unfortunately for a Tory PM, represented by SNP MPs. Och, well, you can't win them all. And if you're Liz winning the poisoned chalice of the Tory leadership just as the wheels come off Britain's marketised society, might prove to be your only real success. Beyond drawing attention to the Tories' Scotland trouble, the new leader's first speech also earned pelters for her pronunciation of Kyiv, the Ukrainian name for their capital as Kiev, the much-hated and now abandoned Russian name. Surprising, really, since Liz was Foreign Secretary until last week and has actually visited a few times, but names can be so darned confusing. In February, Liz caused a stooshy by telling the BBC, "We are offering extra support to our Baltic allies across the Black Sea." Baltic Sea? Black Sea? I suppose it's an easy enough mistake to make. But back to that first speech. There was another unforced error, the unexpected revelation that the next general election will be in 2024. Now, the Fixed Term Parliaments Act was repealed this March, so the timing of a general election is now determined by the Prime Minister, not the law or the calendar. That's an important prerogative Truss relinquished in 5 careless seconds. Now, of course, the 2024 target date could yet change, especially if the economy tanks, the energy price freeze doesn't happen, doesn't work, doesn't apply to public bodies like hospitals and small businesses, or turns out to be a repayable loan. Already, it's rumoured, letters of no confidence in Truss have been written, and plans are afoot amongst MPs who backed rival candidates to cause trouble and boycott key Commons votes. But a third Tory leader in as many years, it's not a good look. And Conservative turkeys are unlikely to vote for Christmas and the near certainty of defeat in an early election. So 2024 probably will be the date. But the point is that having mentioned 2024 in her victory speech, Truss will now look weak and uncertain if she goes early. And she's given the attention-seeking one in Bute House a pretty good steer about timescales. Now, Truss sympathisers might shrug and say, whatever. Heat of the moment, a lot on her mind, small slip-ups, prove she's human. After all, Trump and Johnson thrived on making fairly massive mistakes. But Truss ain't no Trump, and she ain't no Boris. She has none of the charm that unaccountably worked so well south of the border, none of his humour and florid turn of phrase, and none of the unshakable self-confidence that saw him stand down on Tuesday without a word of apology or contrition. nor was she president of the Oxford University Debating Union, learning to advance opposing arguments as wholeheartedly as though she backed with flair, convincibility, and without three-second pauses. Perhaps this explains her peculiar air of inauthenticity, for all those protestations of fervent right-wingery and placebo Thatcherism, the new PM is neither one thing nor the other. Not to the manner born, not a genuine product of the masses. Thus there's no Johnsonian arrogance or Trumpian swagger about Liz Truss, which some folk may find a relief, but that leaves her as an exceptionally lacklustre speaker, whose very first speech as Tory party leader, visible for months, was also littered with mistakes and unforced errors. To say this doesn't augur well is a massive understatement. Look beyond that clumsy peroration and her equally perfunctory speech outside Downing Street, and there's already a pattern. Just as she okayed a vital keynote speech that was actually full of mistakes, Truss is advancing a policy platform that just doesn't add up. She wants tax cuts to promote growth in the teeth of a certain recession. Madness, even according to old Tories like Ken Clark. She's planning a bonfire of EU workers' rights to boost growth, even though EU members with better holiday rights, sickness pay and maximum working hours have higher growth rates than the flatlining UK. And of course, she may still be planning to gerrymander the next Indie Ref, despite the idea being roundly trashed even by Scots Tories. Yet even that provocative proposal carries a now characteristic Truss mistake. Why bother devising victory thresholds for a referendum when which you've insisted will never, ever happen? Or is that not the official line anymore? Oops. In a way, the crazy plan was a backhanded compliment. It proves that whatever the new Prime Minister says in public, in private, she knows Indie Ref 2 will happen. Cheers, my dear. Chuck in her determination to scrap the Northern Ireland Protocol to impress madcap Eurosceptics, although it'll prompt a trade war that Brexit bomb Britain simply cannot afford, and the picture is complete. Welcome to Liz Truss and her lacklustre, clumsy, bull in a china shop approach to governance. Of course, the chaos and contradiction about to be unleashed on voters will come as no surprise to erstwhile cabinet colleagues. It's why most of them didn't vote for her. Boris Johnson was once quoted as saying, "Anything passed her way needs to be handled with care, because she does tend to blow things up," a description that earned Truss her Whitehall nickname, the Human Hand Grenade. Yep, this is our new Prime Minister. Even before a first Prime Minister's questions where she struggled to explain why there will be no windfall tax, easily swayed Southern voters weren't impressed. Two snap polls make dire reading for the Tories. YouGov found 67% had no confidence in her ability to tackle inflation and control energy bills. Another, by Savanta Comrades, found 61% want a general election. But you don't need a poll to know that Liz Truss has competition in Scotland. Two women will dominate the airwaves over the next difficult 18 months. One is already struggling, the other is in a different league as a politician and a communicator. Compare and contrast. Now, it's a mistake to write off a new Prime Minister. Difficult for male opposition leaders to tackle a female leader without looking aggressive, and a mistake to get cocky about the prospects for independence. But surely, this week, they got a whole lot stronger. This article was by Leslie Riddoch from The National of Thursday, the 8th of September 2022, from the comment section. David Pratt, Liz Truss's approach to diplomacy is a problem in this volatile world. When any mention of Liz Truss comes up, a certain image comes to my mind's eye. No, it's not the cheese, pork and apple speeches, haunting as it is. Rather, it's what best could be described as the equivalent, in diplomatic terms, of watching a lamb go to the slaughter. I often think that if Truss has recurring nightmares about what it's like to be in at the political deep end, then the events of a certain day back in February this year must surely have invoked her waking up in the middle of a night with a start and in a cold sweat. I'm talking about the encounter between Truss, then British Foreign Secretary, and her Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, a man who epitomises one of my late mother's favourite old sayings about someone who is not backward in coming forward. As the account of that meeting goes, Lavrov asked Truss whether the UK accepted that two Russian regions, Voronezh and Rostov, belonged to Russia, and that Moscow had the right to move troops and equipment to the areas. According to the Russian daily business newspaper Kommersant, Truss replied that the UK will never recognise Russian sovereignty over these regions. It was then left to the British ambassador in the meeting to quickly correct Truss, who, commentators said, most likely thought Lavrov was referring to Donetsk and Luhansk, the two breakaway regions of eastern Ukraine, controlled by pro-Russian separatists and now a front line in the war between Russia and Ukraine. I thought it worth revisiting this little faux pas by Truss, just to put in perspective the dangers that lie ahead on the UK foreign policy front, given her anointment this week by the Tory faithful to the highest office in the land. It's not news, of course, that Truss's performance, short of hoodwinking her Tory colleagues that she is equipped for the job of Prime Minister, has been woeful on every level. But barely hours into the job, if the new PM is in any doubt as to what her old nemesis Lavrov and his Russian cronies have in store for her government, she need look no further than yesterday's remarks by President Vladimir Putin at the Eastern Economic Forum in the Russian Pacific city of Vladivostok, insisting that Russia had gained, not lost, from the war in Ukraine. Putin said it was now embarking on a new sovereign path that would restore Russia's global clout. Scoffing at Western attempts to cap prices for Russian oil and gas and calling the idea stupid, Putin said that Russia will not supply anything at all if it is contrary to our interests, in this case economic interests, no gas, no oil, no coal, no fuel, oil, nothing. As for Truss herself, Putin's spokesman Dmitry Peskov said it was hard to imagine anything worse for UK-Russian relations than Truss becoming Prime Minister. On that single point, a worsening of relations with the UK government, Scots at least are sure to have some empathy with Peskov, even while knowing that Russia's invasion of Ukraine has done more damage to international relations than just about any other action of recent years. And so the scene is now set for an even bigger showdown between the UK and Russia. That the UK is walking into that confrontation with Truss at the helm doesn't bear thinking about. This, after all, is a politician who, only days before coming to office, told the penultimate Tory leadership hustings that the jury is still out on whether the French President Emmanuel Macron was friend or foe. Talk about how not to win friends and influence people on the international stage, precisely when a show of solidarity is what's needed in the face of Russian aggression in Ukraine. That said, though, as Ben Judah, the British-French journalist and senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Europe Centre, observed recently about Britain's new Prime Minister, it would be easy to make one of two mistakes about Truss. Either she doesn't believe in anything, or she believes everything she's saying at any one time. Instead, says Judah, Truss is a more complicated mix of chameleon politics over a solid framework of belief, especially on geopolitics. At one and the same time, she is hawkish on Russia and China, and, as Judah warns in Foreign Policy magazine this week, has, quotes, a taste for even greater action on the world stage after being Foreign Secretary during a European war. End of quotation. In other words, batten down the hatches. Come to think of it, though, you don't have to cast that far back to get a real understanding of where Truss as PM sees Britain's foreign policy coming from and its likely future trajectory. In a speech at Chatham House in London last year, she spoke of the need for a confident, outward-looking, patriotic and positive country that, rather than being racked with shame about its colonial past, should be proud again of what we are and what we stand for. If there are echoes of Margaret Thatcher here, and a mindset straight out of the days of the Falklands War in 1982, then that should come as no surprise. The terrifying problem with this, though, is that the world is an altogether very different place from those times during Britain's small but bloody spat with Argentina. In Europe, the largest conventional military attack that's been seen since World War II is underway, with Russia's invasion of Ukraine posing the biggest threat to peace and security since the end of the Cold War. In continuing to respond, the UK government's relationship with its allies, especially the US, remains crucial, and there too might lie a problem with Truss. There is a story that shortly after she was appointed Foreign Secretary, Truss met her US counterpart Antony Blinken for the first time last September, and things were not exactly cordial after she questioned the much-vaunted special relationship between the US and UK. As one correspondent in the Financial Times summed it up more recently, Truss's attitude was, "What have you done for me lately?" and did not go down well with the Americans. It was a conversation, the correspondent said, that was emblematic of a style US official described as blunt, binary and assertive. And there you have it. Just what's needed right now on an already volatile international stage, especially when combined with certain shortcomings on the understanding front. Add to this the fact that James Cleverly is now in the Foreign Secretary's role, and it's a pretty fair bet that Truss will struggle to make friends, but easily make enemies on the world stage. This article was by David Pratt.
From The National, Tuesday the 8th of December 2022, from the sports section. Mark Hatley floats Rangers crisis talk as he details importance of win over Aberdeen. By Aidan Smith. Mark Hatley insists Rangers are one defeat away from a crisis if they are to slip up against Aberdeen on Saturday. The Ibrox club are heading into the lunchtime kickoff after 2-4-0 defeats at the hands of Celtic and Ajax in the Champions League. Pressure is now building on Giovanni van Bronckhorst, and former Ibrox striker Hatley admits performances have to improve quickly. Asked if there is a decision to be made around van Bronckhorst's future, he told Sky Sports News, "That is down to the board. I think you have to see where you are domestically. It is still early in the season. Players are still settling in. It is a cutthroat business. When you are managing the top clubs, the pressures are there. The demands from fans and boards determine if you stay or go. At the moment, it is a crucial game at the weekend at Aberdeen. There is a lot of pressure on that game. Then there is a Napoli game to come on the Tuesday night. Looking at how they played against Liverpool, it will be a very tough game. First and foremost, they have to digest what happened last night. You are literally one defeat away from a crisis, and that is the way it has always been. That article was by Aidan Smith. From The National, Thursday the 8th of September 2022, from the sports section. Sunderland star Ross Stewart ruled out upcoming Scotland games. By Ewan Paterson. Scotland have been dealt an injury blow ahead of their upcoming games at the end of this month. Steve Clarke's side take on Ukraine twice and Ireland once in the latest round of UEFA Nations League games. Ukraine will be back at Hampden on September the 21st, with the return feature taking place in Poland on September the 27th. In between, Ireland will be in town on September the 24th. The squad has yet to be announced for the crucial international games, but it has been revealed that Stewart will not be part of it. The ex-Ross County star picked up a thigh injury while warming up for Sunderland ahead of their clash against Middlesbrough earlier in the week. It's undoubtedly a blow for both his club and country, with Stewart scoring 5 in 7 appearances so far this campaign. It is expected he will be out for up to 8 weeks while he recovers. Tony Mowbray told the club's official website, "Ross will be out for 6 to 8 weeks. It could be a little longer, but that will depend on his rehabilitation and the way his body reacts. He's a really positive guy, and we hope that he will be a quick healer. We will take it game by game, and hopefully he returns quickly." That article was by Ewan Payton.
And that was this week's The National Podcast, normally recorded in our studio at the Bishop Briggs Media Centre, currently recorded from our volunteers' homes with the publisher's kind permission. Thanks for listening.